702
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Streaming on 702.co.za.
The 702 app.
And on DStv channel 856.
It's The Money Show, and it's brought to you by Absa Commercial Property Finance. That's African Asset. Absa is a registered FSP. My name is Arabile Kumete, standing in for Bruce Whitfield this Friday evening as we get straight into The Money Show. Then, very interesting things to have happened. Of course, SAA has that lingering effect, doesn't it? We continue to try and find out what exactly is going to happen with the parastatal. When will they get off the ground? Well, today, it seems July, August seems to be the touted time. Whether that actually comes to fruition, though, is the big question mark. We had SAA under business rescue for the longest of time, from December 2019 right through until earlier this year. In fact, just around a month ago now, less than that, if that is to be taken into account. Is it plausible? Is the plan plausible to have SAA back in the skies by July? And even if it does happen, surely it will operate at a much smaller capacity, and that is bound to hurt them even more. Also, we get into your brutal biz quiz today, but our Friday file with Inga Kubeka is the founder of Inga Atelier. And we get into how leather and leather goods became his commercial business. And that's where he decided to hide his talents. We'll get into all of that and a whole lot more. Even the rise of the private owner wine collection. What exactly that's about with Ronald Peens, the senior wine specialist at Strauss & Co. All of that and more coming up this evening. Here we go. It's The Money Show.
Walking this talk together.
Every hour.
Every day. This is 702.
Let's walk the talk.
Just a little bit more with regards to that SAA story as we hopefully get to unpack it in just a bit. Very interesting how things have actually come to bear there. 2.7 billion rand is still needed to fulfill the actual business rescue plan that was set forward for the entire SAA, but 2.7 billion is now needed just for the subsidiaries, that being SAA Technical, which of course is getting to a point where it's doing a Section 189 process and getting rid of over 1,000 staff from the 2019 staff that it had. It had over 80 planes that it was repairing and maintaining before the pandemic began. And in March this year, that number went down to 34. So, of course, 83% of its revenue went down, and that's why it will receive 1.6 billion rand of the 2.7 billion that is still set to be given to the subsidiaries of SAA. Air Chefs as well as Mango is also said to get some funding. But even when all of that comes to bear, when SAA does finally get up and running, who will SAA Technical really be able to maintain and service if SAA doesn't work at the right level or at the same level it used to before the pandemic hit? Chris Christodoulou is an aviation and commerce director at Christodoulou and Mavericks Inc. Chris, thank you so much for the time this evening. So, is it plausible SAA back in the skies in the month of July?
Good evening, Arabile, and thanks for having me on your show. I think that's the question on everybody's lips, and really, without insight into what government is planning and what the board has got in front of it in terms of a plan, I think it's all speculation at this stage. And really, at the bottom of it all is the question of market demand and where we are with COVID. What is going to happen with the vaccine rollout and whether, you know, people will be traveling? Is there demand to get into the sky before we even think about any of the other issues that are going to be impacting on the ability or readiness for SA to take to the sky?
Yeah, that's going to be the big one. I mean, they've touted to go to Cape Town, Durban, if I'm not mistaken, Gqeberha as well, being added to the list on just the South African front. Regionally, the hope is to still go to quite a few African countries. But SAA will not be functioning at the same level it was before the pandemic and before the lockdown. So it means that even so, all the other parts of the business are not going to be making any money, and they were struggling to make money even before the pandemic. So do we see a sustainable future then for SAA, considering right now it sits in debt, right now it needs funding, and right now it needs more money, and we still don't have that equity partner?
Yeah, I think it's all a question of timing. I mean, we see how Comair and the others and Fly Safair managed to, come out of business rescue and take to the sky within, you know, a couple of months. But that was because the lockdown and the non-operational time period was quite short. SAA has now been non-operational for far longer time than those other airlines. You've got to take into account a lot of the operational aspects in terms of being ready. We think about pilots and crew. Are they up to date? Are the aircraft secured? Have they got the correct aircraft? And are all the support teams ready and available to start working? SAA Technical being the first one, even catering, chefs, air chefs, etc., are they going to be up and ready and have the funding to provide those support services? I mean, that is, you know, critical to the airline being sustainable. And especially the big, big question is the money going to be coming in fast enough and to sustain the airline?
Yeah, it's very worrisome. And one doesn't see how things are going to get to that point where it looks like a feasible plan. Let me put you on the spot, Chris, if you'll allow me. What sure. should they perhaps do at a stage like this? Should they have stayed maybe in business rescue, which of course was already, it was the process itself was already going on for too long. 17 months is a very long time. Or should they perhaps have really tried to sell off the entire entity to another equity partner? Or, you know, what could have actually been done here?
You know, it's easy to look back and to pick holes into the process. But we must always remember that business rescue was designed really to get a company back into operation as quickly as possible. Everybody, you know, touted the 6 months as the yardstick. Having gone so far, you can't carry that process on. I would never have recommended that business rescue continue for so long, but obviously there were a lot of factors that were moving around the table, and that's hence the inordinate time that the airline was under business rescue. So looking forward and saying, should we have sold it off? I know personally I was of the opinion that there was a lot more money to be made in selling off some key components and then keeping a very slick, tight networked airline operating would have been by far the better option. I mean, just on my mind always was Voyager as a program could easily have been sold off, and a lot of money could have been taken in from that side. SAA Technical right in the beginning was worth a lot of money. I think those opportunities have been missed, and they now have to deal with what they've got at their disposal.
Can SAA then survive on what is unfortunately the little scraps that it may get in the form of its current aviation plan for the foreseeable future, you think?
Yeah, I think if all the factors that come together favorably, particularly demand, securing the right aircraft, and really having just enough of a kitty in terms of operating capital, there's a possibility that if you combine all of those with a sound business plan that is not over-ambitious, and that, I think, is the biggest problem. I believe government is over-ambitious in terms of how they see and want to see this airline spread all over the continent and internationally. It can work. It can be sustainable, and it could prove a lot of the pundits wrong.
I suppose the third wave of COVID-19 or the persistence of the pandemic is also going to be absolutely key to whether it recovers in time or not.
Certainly. It's all about market demand. It's all about people filling those seats and being confident to fly. And of course, South Africans being able to, access destinations to travel to. You know, African countries, both tourists and business, are waiting for us, but will they allow us in? Are we going to be, vaccinated? Are we going to be off these red lists? And if that's the case, then, it can happen.
Chris Christodoulou, Aviation and Commerce Director at Christodoulou and Mavericks Inc. Thank you so much for the time this evening. Appreciate it. SAA plans to be in the air in July. Plausible or not, time, I suppose, will tell, as we've seen before with SAA and its plans to fly again.
Walking this talk together.
Every hour.
Every day. This is 702.
Let's walk the talk.
So a single owner private collection of fine wines from Bordeaux, Burgundy, Alsace, and even Champagne. Why the need? Why the rise in significance? Why have so many people gotten into the fine wine industry, if we'll call it so? Strauss & Co. have also said that their fine wine is, they're proud to offer what is supposedly the finest cellar ever offered at auction in South Africa. Let's talk about the rise for this private owner wine collection, why people are flocking to it, so to speak, as well. Ronald Peens is the senior wine specialist at Strauss & Co. Ronald, thank you so much for the time this evening. Great growth in this industry and people perhaps getting into it a whole lot more.
Thanks, Arabile. Yeah, so the Strauss & Co. Fine Wine is a partnership between wine seller Hugo Jacobs and Strauss & Co., the elite auction house in South Africa. And 2 years ago, we started this venture looking at the opportunity to sell and buy a secondary market fine wines in South Africa. Of course, the majority of the fine wines are local wines, South African wines, because there wasn't a platform in South Africa to sell your vintage wines. But this collection is all international wines, and it's all extremely rare, fine vintage wines from Bordeaux and Burgundy. And some of these wines are just impossible to find anywhere in the world. And we're very lucky enough to have them here in South Africa on sale on Sunday.
Let's talk about, the starting price of some of these. I mean, this could go literally for really thousands and thousands really of rand in some instances. Do you expect to really get a huge number of people into the auction, getting their hands in? I mean, how many people have sort of said that they're very interested in getting in on the auction?
Yes, yeah, so we've had really good uptick. And last year we went online with our auctions, and we now do virtual live auctions where you'll see Alistair on Sunday literally auctioneering in front of you. You can go to the auction live yourself, or you can participate online. And our record last year was 500 online bidders at one stage on one of our auctions. You must remember this is part of a Strauss & Co. fine art sale as well, where Preller and Stern and Kentridge will all be on sale. I think there's around 70 or 80 million rands worth of art. But these fine wines, Arubila, yes, they go up to about 100,000 rand per bottle, which sounds quite unfathomable. But really, that just shows the demand around the world for some of these fine wines. And what's really interesting, I was doing some analysis today, that if you had bought, for instance, the Lafite 2000 en premier, which would have been in around 2001, you would have paid around 1,300 rand a bottle. And on Sunday, it's going to sell somewhere around 25,000 rand a bottle. And that's a return of 15% annualized. So not only are these fine wines just incredible collector's items and drinking down the line, but they can be phenomenal investments too.
In the words of Drake, I don't drink every bottle I own. I am aging things too. And it's so critical. How does, I want to get perhaps a sense of understanding here. How does one get to, age a particular wine? I mean, I can't just take any old wine, right? And just say, I'm going to keep this for, if you take the Lafite Rothschild, as you made note of there, 2000, 2001, so about 20 odd years. I can't just keep any bottle of wine, keep it for 20 years and then hope to sell it for about 25,000 rand, can I? I mean, surely there's sort of a way of knowing and realizing what's going to be, special at a later stage. How does that ascertain?
It's all about track record. Lafite was one of the finest wines that Thomas Jefferson drank in his heyday. So these wines are very much long-term assets, and they age extremely well. We know that because we've had very, very old ones. And so as a collector, you start understanding which were the ones that that appreciate over the time, which are the ones that increase in value and get better over time. And certainly you can't just go out and off the shelf buy wines and sell them. So a wine cellar is a professional cellaring operation where you would open accounts and you would buy these wines, and they would keep the cold chain all the way from the Chateau all the way into your cellar, and you could keep them as long as you want and until you feel the need of either drinking them or cellaring them. So really, it's an alternative asset which I think more and more people are getting into, and it's starting to really make a name for itself as an alternative asset out there.
Yeah, are you finding that people are actually, you know, buying these wine for that asset purpose to kind of keep hold, and maybe at a later stage decide to sell off again in order to get that sort of capital gain almost at a later stage, or are they actually planning to drink them later?
Well, so I think there are various strategies, but it all started really with Bordeaux wines in the UK, let's call it mid-last century, where collectors would buy a case of first growth and they'd buy five cases of second and third growth. And then in 10 years' time, they would sell the first growth case, and that would then be sufficient to pay for the whole collection, and they would effectively drink for free. And that was the sort of the way to do it. And now today you have exchanges like Livex who are returning millions of pounds a month worth of fine wine trades, and the fine wine market, the global fine wine market's worth about £6 billion. So really we're at a point where technology has enabled us to trade wine like we trade any share on the stock market. And that makes it more exciting for wine professionals like us at Wine Cellar and at Strauss, where we're able to reach more people, showcase more wines. And like this specific collection on Sunday, we're able to sell some of the finest wines here at the tip of Africa, and we're able to reach a global market.
Has the pandemic affected things in any way, particularly in the form of demand, less disposable income from people? Or have you found that demand has actually increased because, you know, people weren't necessarily spending their money on other things also?
Yeah, Reb, on the Strauss & Co. fine wines and on the Wine Cellar side, we were up quite dramatically last year. And that's really because we've focused on e-commerce, and our customers are online more than they ever have been before, and they're able to research more about the wines and be at home, not in a restaurant, drinking their own collections. So it's actually been quite positive, to be honest. And if you look at the Livex Fine Wine Index, it certainly did not have the dip that was experienced in other equity markets and commodities. So as an uncorrelated asset, fine wine is certainly out there and starting to become a lot more mainstream.
Not just the alternative asset, but certainly an asset to keep for the future and one to look out for. Ronald Pienz, thank you so much for the time. Really appreciate it. Senior wine specialist at Strauss & Co., the rise of the private owner wine collection. An auction this weekend, then a virtual live auction happening on Sunday, the 16th of May at 11 a.m. as the single owner private collection of fine wines will be going under the hammer. Also interesting, still certain parts of the world that, of course, are still looking to find gains.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
So the JSE managing to gain 0.2% today to close out the day's portion, having finally gone past 69,000 points at some stage this week as well. So very interesting market picture. Negativity in some parts of the world, of course. The United States, that inflation data print this week. Asia, a few holidays in some parts, but certainly also trying to track the U.S. for the most part. Andrew Bryson, portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth. Thank you for joining us this evening. Let's get straight into that market picture. A topsy-turvy one this week, hasn't it? And I mean, all due to the jobs numbers and inflation print.
Yes. Hi, Arabia. Yeah, it's been a tough market overall, although we've seen a bit of a bounce today. You know, as you alluded to, the inflation number in the States did come out as quite a shock. And I think it probably brought some investors thinking around rate hikes in the U.S. Further forward, and you know, high rates tend to be negative for stocks. So yeah, not a good week overall. Although we are seeing some bargain hunting coming through today. I think in our own market, you know, standout gainers were the gold shares. It's been a good week, or it's been a good start to May for gold in general. With gold up about $100 and gold shares up today about 3%. You know, I think as geopolitics also comes into play in that sector, and you know, maybe a bit of risk off into that sector.
Yeah, the risk-off trade, though, I suppose, is all in preparation for what will the Fed do next. They sort of put out a statement early on having said that, look, they plan to keep things as they are. They're hoping for a full-on recovery first before they start moving in that direction. Do you think the market then prices in sort of an alleviation or a cut of the bond buying purchase program later this year, or does that still move into next year and beyond?
Yeah, I think, you know, the Fed's been quite clear that, you know, they're going to do everything to keep the economy going in the States. We've seen a strong, we are seeing a strong rebound in U.S. growth this year. I think the problem factor and the reason why markets came off this year is, you know, if there is an uncontrollable spike in inflation, you know, that might force their hand, you know, although they would like to do everything in their power not to see rates move, you know, anytime soon. Sometimes it might be out of their control, and I think that's what investors are concerned about.
Yeah. This may not necessarily be one you follow too hard, but, I mean, the Bitcoin story is still fairly interesting, or the cryptocurrency story with a little bit more attraction then coming through from Elon Musk then. It does put a little bit of pressure on the regulated market to kind of look at this with a little bit more of a beady-eyed look to say, is it a viable investment? Is that something you're getting into or seeing as a thought process then, Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, certainly I think clients are watching it more and more these days. And we have seen a lot more institutional take-up in the States. You know, sort of Tesla doing an about turn, you know, they were sort of very positive on Bitcoin and are sort of, you know, going the other way. But, you know, it's certainly something that is a debate when chatting to clients about, you know, their investments and, you know, what new markets are out there. I mean, from a Bitcoin perspective, we've seen listed ETFs come through in Canada and in Europe. So, you know, certainly a wider take up from institutional type markets that weren't looking at it, you know, maybe a year or so ago.
Yeah. All right. Company specific locally, Sasol selling that 30% stake in their Mozambican business, then the pipeline investments company that they had there for just over 4 billion rand. How difficult is it still for Sasol, you think? I mean, they still look to be going on these disposals because, unfortunately, they're still in a bind when it comes to their debt.
Yeah, so they're in a far better situation. I mean, you know, oil prices are back above $60. So, you know, the cash flow is coming in. You know, they've also been quite successful with the sales to this point. So I think, you know, their debt levels are going to be, you know, very manageable, you know, by the end of the year. So I think this is another move to sort of improve the balance sheet. But I think they're under far less pressure, you know, than they were, you know, 6 months or so ago.
Yeah. Do they remain, should I say, of still a viable sort of investment then as well? Considering that, you know, 50% of that U.S. project has, you know, is sold, they are stabilizing things. The CEO is seemingly getting a grip of things. Do they need to continue selling? I mean, at this point, or is it a case of, okay, now we just steady the ship and allow the income to keep coming because of the stabilization as well and the oil prices, as you noted?
Yeah, so absolutely. I mean, they have restabilized the ship, and you know, debt levels are at far more manageable levels. You know, they've also got rid of some non-core assets. So I think, you know, given where the oil price is and how the business operations are looking going forward, you know, we think this share is probably cheap at this level, even though we've seen a sort of a 10 times rally over the last year.
Yeah, very interesting then for Sasol as the picture. All right, Andrew, appreciate the time. Thank you so much for it. Andrew Bryson, Portfolio Manager at Sanlam Private Wealth. A sense of the market picture then, how things are faring across today. It's the Friday close of the JSE, up 0.2% at the close of trade today. Very interesting pictures across the week then, as we saw that inflation printout in the United States come out a little bit worse than expected, should we say. And then, of course, out in Asia, as we continue to see the story unfold in those markets too.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Commercial Property Finance, committed to delivering innovative solutions for groundbreaking developments. That's African Nacity. Absa is a registered FSP. The Money Show.
The Friday File.
The Friday File.
It's the story of a boy who grew up in an underprivileged and marginalized village in the Eastern Cape of South Africa, people living well below the poverty line, not exposed to supposedly the finer things. Inga was raised by his grandmother and grew up making wire cars and little clay cows as well as houses. Used all of that experience, all of that, to then hide his talent behind leather bags and the fashion industry. The creative director, Inga Kubeka, joins us now as we get into our Friday File feature. Inga, thank you so much for the time, brother. Really, really appreciate it. I'm really excited for this interview. We've spoken before, but just continuing to talk about your journey is so great and really, really awesome. Inga Atelier, where did that start from and what is it all about?
Thank you so much, Aravile. I'm so glad to be here. Once again, be interviewed by you. I really appreciate it. I'm truly humbled. Inga Atelier is my name. Atelier is a studio in French. A lot of people think that my surname is Atelier and always laugh at us because my surname is Kubeka, except that Atelier is a studio in French. So I thought I should use my name and studio, so meaning that Inga Studio. So that's where it all began with Inga Atelier.
In getting to this journey, though, you know, the thought process behind what it is you could create, what made you think one leather bags and that element and making it, shall we say, the finer things or a luxury brand as well? What brought that about and why this part of the fashion industry per se?
Yes. So basically, I was inspired by the people, you know, like in South Africa, for example. In fact, in the African continent, we are the biggest consumers of the luxury brands and products, yet we don't have our own. In fact, we've got little of our own. So I thought to myself, if Africans can buy your Gucci's, your Louis Vuitton, and all the other expensive luxury brands, why not create our very own here in South Africa, made in South Africa by South Africans, but with a global feel to it, you know, with something similar to what they have abroad in terms of quality and excellent workmanship. That's what inspired me to start Inga Atelier. It was mainly to compete, you know, against all the big luxury brands because we are the market of the luxury brands, but why don't we have our own luxury products in South Africa, in fact, in Africa? So that brought about the idea of starting one, to compete on a global scale with the rest of the products out there.
Yeah, Inga, are you finding that people are becoming a little bit more accepting, susceptible to actually taking on our very own designers? I mean, we have quite a few now that have really made headlines, not just on the local front, but globally, including yourself. Are you finding that South Africans are really now backing our very own a whole lot more than we used to?
Yes, absolutely. And I'd like to thank, you know, like the buy and support local movement. You know, it's doing wonders for us as local designers. And people, yes, they're starting to warm up, to open up, you know, about supporting local brands and supporting local designers. But we still have a long way to go. We still have to educate the consumers, you know, especially when it comes to the price point, you know, because the question becomes, why is this so expensive? And the answer to that is that it's a handcrafted product. It's a luxury product, you know. It's a bespoke, it's a handmade product, and therefore there's a lot of thought process and a lot of workmanship behind it, hence the price. And there's expensive materials that are being used. For instance, leather is not cheap on its own, you know. Now you can imagine making products out of leather. So that's why, like, sometimes we need to educate our consumers, especially about the price points, because that is now the outcry, you know, from the consumers, that no, but the price points are ridiculous. And I don't think we are. We're still very much below what the luxury leather goods charge. But again, they've got heritage behind them. They've been in existence for years and years. So we can't exactly charge exactly like them per se at this moment. But as the brand grows, we will be able to charge a little bit higher as well.
It's also very critical then to get the support of fashion houses and stores. Perhaps if you don't have your own store, things like pop-up stores, like being able to sell online. How critical has that sort of been in the journey too? Because yes, the price point is important because people need to understand why it exactly costs this much. But once you get to a point where you're able to access your market, you know, just between you and the market and the buyer themselves, you're able to perhaps express things a whole lot better. Have you been able to do that, particularly having seen the pandemic as well over the last year?
No, I think the last year has been very incredible. In fact, the last couple of years, last 2 years, I'd say. I mean, we had our pop-up in Hyde Park, which went very well. We did that just to test the market, you know, like, hence we opened it at more like Hyde Park, you know, just to test the market in terms of, you know, like the feel and how it, what it's like, you know, to be trading in a mall like that with a very high income earners. And then we quickly moved away from that due to the lockdown that hit last year, and we wanted to focus online. We've seen increase of sales online than we've ever seen before. And I don't want to say that's the lockdown, but I think it contributed to the whole buying online and shopping online culture, because there's been like a big switch in terms of online and online buyers and online shoppers. I mean, we've experienced that. In fact, we decided not to go back into retail anytime soon because online seems to be working very well for us. You know, like better than we've ever seen it. So we're excited about that.
Yeah, that really is an exciting journey out on that front. I mean, the need to continue to elevate the business, to get it better, to get it bigger, to perhaps not necessarily change course, but you know, bring in new aspects and continue to innovate. How are you dealing with that? And how are you continuing to get that through into your business so that you don't stay behind at any point?
Yes, it's very simple. I mean, for instance, right now, it's very important to innovate, you know, and also like to stay on trend. So basically, my thought process and my design process is very simple. So I know what the focus is going to be for the next 6 months in terms of the bags that are being trend. So you'll notice that there's a trend, like, for instance, all the big luxury brands, your Chanel, your Louis Vuitton, your Bottega, and everybody, they have, like, a very similar bag, you know, like, that almost everybody has, which is what we also do as well. So yeah. We've got a bag that is very similar to all the other bags that other brands are doing, luxury brands that are doing. But we also have, like, the range of now our core range that is designed and well thought, you know, like by myself, and product developed and all of that we develop. So that is my design process basically around Inga T and staying on top and staying on trend as well.
Brother, where to from here?
From here, we're going international. I'm proud to announce that we are now operating from Dubai, which is amazing.
Wow.
We've got a warehouse. We've got a warehouse in Florida, and we ship all the stuff, you know, across the world from Florida, which is fantastic. And we now do our operations in Dubai. I've got my team sitting in Dubai, and I'm here in South Africa because I need to overlook the production and product development and so forth. So yeah, we're going global.
Inga, this is absolutely huge. I just love to hear it, brother. Look, you being in the international sphere is so, so great. It's so wonderful to hear. Inga Kubeka, thank you so much for the time, but really great story to hear. The brands just keep on growing locally. We're trusting our finders, our creative directors, those that come up with luxury items that we're perhaps looking at and saying, we don't necessarily only need the international brands anymore. We can do it ourselves. We can find our very own, and that we can continue to build, be proud of, and then be able to export. I mean, just think of all the people we've been able to export to the globe and how important they have been to the rest of the world. Now we can even produce items, services, whatever it may be. We're still capable of competing even on the global stage.
Walking this talk together.
Every hour.
Every day. This is 702.
Let's walk the talk.
All right, then, a couple of minutes till the top of the hour then. We're going to get into the brutal biz quiz as we usually do on a Friday evening also. So we're going to just give you a hint of the first question. You can start calling in, of course, 011-883-0702-0214-460567 if you'd like to take part in this evening's brutal biz quiz. Who wants to be the brutal biz quiz winner? The first question then, one that is going to get tough. I see a few of these questions, man. Producers have been really tough this week, but nonetheless, let's get straight into it. The first question is, Clicks announcing that it's going to purchase a pharmacy business of which supermarket? So of which supermarket is Clicks going to buy the pharmacy business of? We'll get into the answer of that one, please. You can start calling in on 011-883-0702 if you're in Joburg, 021-446-0567 out in Cape Town.
Walking this talk together.
Every hour.
Every day. This is 702.
Let's walk the talk.
Less than 8 minutes to go till the top of the hour then. Let's get straight into it. The brutal biz quiz. 8 questions. We've got Clicks announcing that it's going to purchase a pharmacy business of which supermarket? Flynn out in Cape Town, you have an answer for us with regards to this one. Which retail supermarket is it?
I'm guessing it's the Spa.
Oh, no, unfortunately not Spa. It's not Spa, Flynn, unfortunately not. Roy out in Johannesburg, perhaps you have an answer for us on this one. Which supermarket brand will Clicks be buying the pharmacy business of?
Pick and Pay.
Yep, that's 100% correct. Then Clicks Group said to hold the largest retail pharmacy network now in South Africa with a portfolio of 632 pharmacies in the country. Okay, Roy, let's get straight into the second question then. It's a more international one. It's one that we've been speaking about quite a lot. Which U.S. fuel pipeline was paralyzed this week after a ransomware attack? Pretty much the name of the pipeline that was paralyzed this week.
I think it was the Texas.
It was close to that area. Trying to give you the one of the words is actually even used in our question here. Which U.S. fuel pipeline was paralyzed this week after a ransomware cyber attack?
The U.S. pipeline.
Oh, unfortunately not. Just missing one word on that one. Let's go out to David out in Johannesburg as well then. Which U.S. fuel pipeline was paralyzed this week after a ransomware attack? David, we've already given you the word pipeline effectively. It's just about getting that one word. Do you know which one it is?
I'm taking a chance. I'm really taking a flyer. I'll say Arizona.
No, certainly not. So in terms of clues, just note that the answer to this one, it's not named after the place. It's literally just the name of the pipeline, and it has a name. That pipeline has a name. It starts with a C. Maurice out in Newlands, Cape Town. Do you have an answer for us on this one?
Colorado?
No, not Colorado. Let's go to Joseph out in Kempton Park.
Hello?
Yes, hi, Joseph. Do you have an answer for us? Which U.S. fuel pipeline was paralyzed this week after a ransomware cyber attack?
I have no clue.
Sorry, but okay. Victor, surely you have the right answer for us on this one. We've been trying so often now. Do you have it?
Yeah, it's Colonial.
100% correct. It had shut down about 5,500 miles of pipeline, which carries 45% of the East Coast fuel supplies. Okay, we're going to get into question number three, Victor, with you then. In which city in South Africa did billionaire Dr. Patrick Soon-Shiong, who recently committed to donating 3 billion rand towards vaccine manufacturing in the country, grow up in? So in which city in South Africa did Dr. Patrick Soon-Shiong grow up in here in South Africa?
That one beats me. I'll have to bow out.
Oh, that's unfortunate, Victor. Okay, shall we give a clue here on this one very quickly? It was renamed and it is in the Eastern Cape. So in which city in South Africa did billionaire Dr. Patrick Soon-Shiong, who recently committed to donate 3 billion rand towards vaccine manufacturing in the country, grow up in? Lucky out in Douglasdale, you have an answer.
Yes, I do. It's Gqeberha.
Indeed it is. Gqeberha it is. Sun Xiong was born in Gqeberha in South Africa to Chinese immigrant parents who fled from China during the Japanese occupation in World War II. Lucky, we need to go all the way here, but we're only three questions in. Surely you can get us to the rest. Name a car manufacturer that will not accept Bitcoin as payment due to climate change concerns.
Tesla.
Yep, that's the one. Bitcoin even falling by more than 10% after Elon Musk tweeted that he's a bit worried that it is going to hurt the environment. All right, we're nearly there. We're going to get there. Pierre Fontonda, the CEO of which quick service restaurant group? People with a taste for life. Come on, Lucky.
Oof.
No? Sorry, say that again?
Spare.
Yep, that's the one. You're 100% correct. The former Spurs CEO, Pierre Fontonda, fortunately passing away on Sunday evening, retiring from the restaurant chain back in December. Okay, let's get into it. We have three more questions now, Lucky. You have to stay with me on this one here. Smoo Shabalala, who allegedly hired thugs to beat up his estranged wife's partner, Sipho Ndzuza, is a CEO and founder of which company? So we're looking for what company is Smoo Shabalala the CEO and founder of?
Ooh, not sure about that one. Is that
they usually say if you don't do this, you die.
Standard Bank?
No, it's not Standard Bank. That's Sim Shabalala that you may be looking towards there, unfortunately. So not that one, Victor. Thank you so much for being a part of it, although. Let's go to Danny out in Bitworth Park in the Vol. Danny, who do you think Smoo Shabalala is the CEO and founder of which company?
Can you say if they... Good morning, good evening, Rama. They say if you don't do it, you should die. Who could that be?
If you don't do this one thing, yeah, you may die. Sorry?
So you're saying?
Yeah, so basically, if you don't do this one thing, you either do it or you die.
Hmm.
No?
Is it not Liberty?
No, it's not Liberty, unfortunately not. We're going to get straight to the answer then on this one. Unfortunately, it's Adapt IT, and my clue, I suppose, was it's either you adapt or die, unfortunately. So that is the Brutal Biz Quiz this evening. As you can tell, my producers, unrelentless, not forgiving today, and really making it as difficult as possible for everyone. That is the Brutal Biz Quiz then for this Friday evening.